Radio 4 Extra.
Now, the Fry Chronicles, Stephen Fry's memoir, which continues where Moab Is My Washpot left off. It takes in his years at Cambridge and his early entry into the worlds of comedy and theatre. In today's episode, Stephen recounts his early desire and expectation of fame and about what really endures, the work.
Alan Bennett has a huge advantage over most of us in that his shyness is known about and expected. Indeed, it is one of the qualities most admired in him. It proves his authenticity, modesty, and the classy distance he naturally keeps from that creepy media gang of loud, confident, shallow, and self-congratulatory wankers to which I cannot but help belong, and which the rest of society so rightly despises. Nobody seems to expect me to be shy, or believes me when I say that I am. I cannot blame them. I seem to move with such ease through the world. I was reminded of this only the other afternoon. I was a guest on the CBS programme The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. Craig is the Scottish comedian who has now become, in the opinion of many, myself included, the best talk show host in America. He told me, as he began the interview, that back in the 80s, when he had been a regular on the British comedy circuit, he had always regarded me as almost unnaturally calm, sorted, and in control, to the extent that he was in a kind of angry awe of me. I ought to be used to being told that, but yet again, it brought me up short. Never, at any point in my life, can I remember feeling that I was any part of assured, controlled, or at ease. The longer I live, the more clearly one truth stands out. People will rarely modify their preferred view of a person, no matter what the evidence might suggest. I am English, tweedy, pucker, confident, establishment, self-assured, in charge. That is how people like to see me, be the truth never so at variance. It may be the case that I'm a Jewish mongrel with an addictive, self-destructive streak that it has taken me years to master. It may be the case that my afflictions of mood and temperament cause me to be occasionally suicidal in outlook and can frequently leave me in despair and eaten up with self-hatred and self-disgust. It may be the case that I am chronically overmastered by a sense of failure, underachievement, and a terrible knowledge that I have betrayed, abused, or neglected the talents that nature bestowed upon me. It may be the case that I doubt I will ever have the capacity to be happy. It may be the case that I fear for my sanity, my moral centre, and my very future. All these cases may be protested, and I can assert their truth as often as I like, but the repetition will not alter my image by one pixel. It is the same image I had before I was a known public figure, the image that caused a delegation of college first-year contemporaries to visit me in my rooms and demand to know my secret. The image that satisfies and impresses some, enrages others, and no doubt bores, provokes, or irritates many more. I would be a tragic figure indeed if I had not learned to live with that persona by now. Like many masks, this smiling, placid one has become so tight a fit that it might be said to have rewritten the features of whatever true face once screamed behind it, were it not that it is just a mask and that the feelings underneath are as they always were. What I want to say about all this wailing is not that I expect your pity or your understanding, although I wouldn't throw either of them out of bed, but that perhaps I am the one actually offering pity and understanding here, for I have to believe that all the feelings I have described are not unique to me, but common to us all. The sense of failure, the fear of eternal unhappiness, the insecurity, misery, self-disgust, and the awful awareness of underachievement that I have described. Are you not prey to all those things also? I do hope so. I would feel the most conspicuous oddity otherwise. I grant that my moments of suicidal ideation and swings of mood may be more extreme and pathological than most have to endure, but otherwise I am surely describing nothing more than the fears, dreads, and neuroses we all share. No, more or less, mutatis mutandis, all things being equal. Oh, please say yes. Aside from University Challenge, the BBC's transmission of the Sellotapes was the first time I had appeared on national television. I don't count There's Nothing to Worry About, which was inflicted only upon viewers in the Northwest ITV region. The morning after the Sellotapes was aired on BBC Two, I went for a walk along the King's Road. How ought I to treat those who approached me? I switched on a sweet, gentle smile and practiced a kind of, who? Me? Gesture that involved looking behind me and then pointing with questioning disbelief at my own undeserving chest. I made sure, before setting out, that there were pens in my pocket as well as some artfully random scraps of paper for autographs. Would I write yours sincerely or with best wishes? I decided that I should try each a few times and see which looked better. The first people I passed as I made my way up Blacklands Terrace were an elderly couple who paid me no attention. Foreigners, possibly, or the kind of Chelseaites who thought it smart not to have a television. A young woman came towards me with a West Highland Terrier on a lead. I added an extra 10% of soupy modesty to my sweet, gentle smile and awaited her gasps and shrieks. She and the terrier passed right by without a flicker of recognition. How very strange. I turned left at the King's Road and walked past the Peter Jones department store and twice around Sloane Square. Not one person stopped me, shot me a sideways glance of admiring recognition, or favoured me with a single puzzled stare that told me that they knew the face but couldn't quite place it. There was simply no reaction from anyone, anywhere. I went into W.H. Smith's and hung around the periodical section, close to the piles of listings magazines. To pick up a Radio Times, people had to ask me to step aside. Obviously, and by definition, these persons must have been television watchers. But my features, by now set into a wild, despairing grin, meant nothing to them. This was most strange. Television, everybody in the world knew, conferred instant fame. One morning you do the weather on BBC One, the next you are besieged at the supermarket checkout queue. Instead, I had woken up to find myself anonymous. I was still nothing more than another face in the London crowd. Maybe almost no one had watched the Footlights show. Or maybe millions had, but I possessed one of those bland, forgettable faces that meant I was doomed never to be recognised. Surely this was unlikely. I had told my face a lot of tough and unforgiving truths in the past, but I had never accused it of being bland or forgettable. I pulled a compensatory BBC Micro magazine from the shelf and left. As I was trailing disappointedly back to the flat, I heard a voice behind me. "Excuse me, excuse me!" I turned to see an excited young girl. At last.
"Yes?"
"You forgot your change." You get the point. Desperate to be famous, but very, very ready, if I didn't make it, to vent my scorn on those who did. I contend that people like me who burn for fame and recognition are much rarer than the prevailing view would have us believe. I take my brother Roger and his family as my touchstone for all that is sane, sound, and decent. They are as modern and connected to the world as anyone else I know. I recall, and I seem to be able to picture it in pin-sharp, high-def, widescreen, 3D detail, an evening at the pantomime in Norwich when I was 7 and Roger was 9. Buttons made his entrance and asked if there were any boys and girls out there who would like to join him up on stage. Roger dropped down in his seat, trying his hardest to look invisible. The idea of being up there in the lights, in front of a staring audience, horrified him. I, meanwhile, was leaping up and down and thrusting my hand into the air, desperate, absolutely desperate to be picked. Two boys, 18 months apart in age, bred in the same conditions and by the same parents. There are many more Rogers in the world, praise be, than Stevens. In fact, I think few people are really obsessed with being famous in the way that I was. Most recoil at the thought, squirming down in their seats like my brother at the very idea of public exposure. They might consider from time to time what fame would be like and conduct thought experiments in which they feature on a red carpet being lit by flashbulbs, but that is no more than the normal fantasy of opening the batting for England or volleying the championship point at Wimbledon. For the most part, Most people are mostly for a quiet life out of the public eye and have a mostly sane understanding of how peculiar fame must be. They are sensible enough not to judge all celebrities as alike, and civil enough not to despise people because they've committed the crime of being a pop singer, a golfer, or a politician. Most people are tolerant, wise, kind, and thoughtful, most of the time. People like me, eaten up with ambition, simmering with resentment, white-hot with neediness at one moment and sullen with frustration and disappointment the next, we are the ones who obsess about fame and status, and it gives us nothing but dissatisfaction, vexation, and horrible doses of heavy angst. All this is embarrassing for me to admit. Those in my line do not own up to such vulgar, cheesy, and undignified yearnings. It is all about the work. If your work happens, unlike insurance, accountancy, or teaching, to bring celebrity in its train, or riches, then so be it. You aim for the game bird of accomplishment. Fame and fortune just happen to be the feathers it flies with. Yeah, right. We know these worthy precepts. I echo and endorse them. But the needy child that hid within the tweedy man screamed to be fed, and the needy child, as always, wanted what was instantly satisfying and instantly rewarding, no matter how shallow and devious that might make him. Shallow and devious is what I was, and probably always will be, and if you have not yet understood how profoundly shallow and how straightforwardly devious I am, then I cannot have been doing my job right. Work was coming in thick and fast. There is no doubt that amongst magazine and newspaper editors, radio, film and TV producers, directors, commissioners and casting agents, I was a coming man, a young shaver useful for all kinds of odds and ends, but I was not famous. A few invitations to film premieres and first nights began to trickle in, but I found that I could walk the red carpet entirely unmolested. I remember going to some event with Rowan Atkinson, the press night of a new play, I think. To hear his name shouted out by photographers and see the crowd of fans pressing up against the crash barriers caused the most intense excitement in me, combined with a sick flood of fury and resentment that no one, not one single person, recognised me or wanted my picture. Oh, Stephen. I clicked on and selected that sentence, deleted it. Restored it, deleted it, and restored it again. A large part of me would rather not have you know that I am so futile, fatuous, and feeble-minded, but an even larger part recognizes that this is our bargain. I cannot speak for others, or presume to drag out their entrails for public inspection, but I can speak for, and against, myself. Maybe I was an advance guard for a new kind of Britain, fanatical about fame, addictive, superficial, gadget-obsessed, and determinedly infantile. Maybe, to put a kinder construction on it, I was living proof that you could want to be famous and want to do the work. You could relish the red carpet and relish lucubrating into the early hours, cranking out articles, scripts, sketches, and scenarios with a genuine sense of pleasure and fulfillment.
Stephen Fry was reading from The Fry Chronicles, which was abridged by Mark McCallum and produced by David Roper for Heavy Entertainment. Tomorrow he has a curious encounter with another Stephen, the legend that is Sondheim.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Luke Tuddenham, and we're about to venture out onto the moors, and more specifically a farmhouse called Wuthering Heights, where one Mr. Lockwood isn't exactly made welcome, the first in a 5-part dramatisation of Emily Bronte's classic in a moment. And in an hour, we'll be trudging through a Somerset ditch in search of Britain's smallest flower in the 4 o'clock show with Mel Gedroych. Now, John Dutton stars with Amanda Root and Sharon Deuce in a love affair that spanned generations and indeed beyond the grave. Part one of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights.
Take me home! I must go home! I've lost my way on the moor! 20 years. Take me home!
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Episode 1.
Young lady! Young lady! Can you help me? Where's she gone? Ah, someone up ahead.
My God, sir, you terrified me coming out of mist like that.
I beg your pardon. I'm lost. I was asking my way of a young lady.
Young lady here on top of moor in this weather? There's only me and my ewes. I think you're daydreaming, sir.
So it would seem. She's vanished into the mist.
Well, you're right fast to your destination, sir. The sky's heavy with snow. See, here come first flakes. It'll be bitter cold soon.
Well, then kindly direct me to Mr. Heathcliff's house.
Heathcliff? What do you want with Heathcliff?
Mr. Heathcliff. I'm Mr. Lockwood, the new tenant of Thrushcross Grange. Mr. Heathcliff is my landlord.
Beg pardon, sir. Mr. Heathcliff lives yonder. On very, very highest brow of the moor. See, where those firs slant towards the hill's edge, an old stone building. Can you see a dim light in the distance?
Yes, I think so.
Well, follow the road as it winds up to it and take care riding. The earth's hard with black frost and this wind will have you over the edge. The light you can see is Mr. Heathcliff's house. That's Wuthering Heights.
Oh, well, my thanks to you. I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. This place is a perfect misanthropist's heaven. And my landlord and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us.